This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
¿Hablas español?
¿Sprichst du Deutsch?
¿Kan du norsk?
If you used Babbel, you would. Babbel's conversation-based techniques teaches you useful words and phrases to get you speaking quickly about the things you actually talk about in the real world. With lessons handcrafted by over 200 language experts and voiced by real native speakers, Babbel is like having a private tutor in your pocket. Start speaking with Babbel today. Get up to 55% off your Babbel subscription right now at babbel.com/Spotify. Spelled BABBEL.com/Spotify. Rules and restrictions may apply.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. We're here. Hope you had a fantastic weekend. We're back in action now. Lawrence Jones is standing by. Senator Scott Brown in 35 minutes. He wants to be the next senator from New Hampshire. It's going to be important right now. Voterama is taking place. And we're going to find out if the big, beautiful bill has a future. We also know that there's a lot of action happening. I know there's a representative from the IDF is coming, and Ron Dermer are coming to see President Trump talking about a Hamas peace deal. We'll see where that goes. And so many questions about what is left of the Iran's nuclear program. But first, let's get to the big three.
Number three. Do you condemn that phrase, globalize the intifada?
That's not language that I use. The language that I use and the language that I will continue to use to lead the city is that which speaks clearly to my intent, which is an intent grounded in a belief in universal human rights.
Really? Zohran Mamdani, pay attention. He's the scariest candidate to win a primary in my lifetime. He hates billionaires, marginalizes white people, despises capitalism, Israel, and perhaps Jews, and it gets worse from there. We have him. In his own mind-boggling words from this weekend.
Number two.
They have to say for the first time, the Iranian regime, we recognize Israel's right to exist, but we recognize Israel has the right to exist as a people, the state of Israel does. If they can't say that, you're never going to get a deal worth a damn.
Wait and see. Iran at a turning point, or is the region at a boiling point? We have the aftermath of the president's impressive strike as Iran prepares to ramp down in Gaza.
Number one.
All these cuts, all this cutback on health care to provide the wealthiest in our country a disproportionate share of tax cuts, that just doesn't seem fair. And the more we can get that out, I think this will be a political albatross.
Yeah, get that out, but it's not accurate. You might have been upset. This is the tax rate from 2017, the big, beautiful bill going through brutal confirmation process as the Voterama has begun. We will tell you where we're at, what's at stake, what the bill is at, and why it's Trump's entire agenda. By the way, on trade deals, Canada seems back on track. Lawrence Jones, first off, the Voterama, essentially a chance for Democrats and Republicans to rant and rave and offer amendments.
Well, I come at this from two places. First, I don't understand why they continue to wait till the last minute to have these debates. They should be working on these bills long before going through the process and all that. But we're always next to a deadline. Number two is there's a lot of stuff in the bill that I don't like. But this is the best you're going to get. You got to be a team player. You got to work through the process. If you're a fiscal conservative like me, get in the room, make your debates happen. And I think that's the case that Ron Johnson was making on the program this morning.
Yeah.
Not a lot of stuff that he likes, but he got some wins.
But see, what I appreciate with Josh Hawley, Ron Johnson, Rick Scott, they're critical, Chip Roy, critical, but they're going to go in there and they're going to create havoc, and they're going to try to get things through, and then they're going to use their maximum leverage in their vote to get what they want. But you know what their goal is? To get it to pass.
Right.
Guys like Tom Massey, Rand Paul, I have no interest in them. I have no use for them. You're not doing your job. Well, I'm a libertarian. I'm not going to get involved. What are you doing there? You owe it to the people that elected you. So what's in the bill? Some of the biggest changes, the tax provisions. Trump's long promised tax incentives for tips, overtime, seniors. Seniors, it's going to be Social Security is going to give a tax deduction. Mm-hmm. The parliamentarian will not let them do it on reconciliation, which is just no tax on tips. And car loans, they're going to give that. They're going to extend the Trump tax cuts, which is going to be great. Wall Street says we kind of expected that, but that's great news for the country. Raises the child tax credit, which is something that Democrats don't seem to acknowledge. And then you have SALT. Mike Lawler is happy. Mm-hmm. SALT stays in for up to $40,000. So the amount is currently capped at $10,000. Both versions of the bill would boost it to $40,000 for married couples and up to $500,000 per year. They can write it off on their taxes.
The problem is, so, and I don't want to jump the gun here, but this is just the process. So they're going to vote on this, right, offer their amendments to this, and then vote on the bill as a whole. Then it's going to go back to the House.
Yep.
They have to rubber all go for it. Yeah. I mean, if not, then we're going to be doing
this. Then
it'll
go back to the Senate.
Right. So, you know, the question is, do we have a team of team players or people that are going to be on their own island? And you just can't have that in this process. You know, they said that they wanted to do two bills. I don't think they could have pulled off two bills. Might as well do it right now, get it over with, get everything that you want done now, and then move on. Right. To checking spending next.
All right, so here's Gary Peters. He's retiring. This is his sense of the bill.
Michigan.
Number one, no Democrats on this. Even Fetterman's not on this. This is all one party. Cut six.
I rise today in opposition to a widely irresponsible legislation that is before us now. Although our colleagues are calling it the big, beautiful bill, this bill would instead be a betrayal to our economic future.
So, Lindsey Graham on the other side, cut five.
If you do what I have decided to do, make the tax cuts permanent, and you implement these reforms to Medicaid in other areas, you will, over the next 10 years, reduce the deficit by $507 billion. That's CBO, not me.
And we're going back and forth on that. So the whole thing is you're betting on growth.
Yeah.
And also you're getting rid of the new a lot of the new Green Deal stuff that was jammed down our throats by Joe Biden.
Well, also you got to take in consideration, Brian, if they don't do anything on this, taxes are going to go up by 68% for most people. I also don't like the argument of counting toward the deficit when there's tax cuts. Just check your spending. The American people shouldn't be penalized for the government going outside of his budget. Mm. So I'm hoping that some of the tariff money as well will go toward paying off the deficit as well, Brian.
Yeah, so Medicaid's the big story. And Josh Hawley, how we're worried about cutting Medicaid. What happened is, and Obamacare knew it, they have opened up Medicaid eligibility by so much, it is now it's bigger than Medicare. And what they did is to Medicaid, which is state run, they said, hey, guys, if you just expand it to other people, we will pay 95% of it. Now, a lot of the Republicans say, because I get this trap. Mm-hmm. At one point, you're going to pull back and I'm going to have all these people on the payroll.
Right.
Even if you don't pull back, isn't this for the federal government going to be unsustainable? But everyone's like, don't worry about it. Then Biden gets elected. And he's boom, boom, boom.
Right.
More and more people up there. And I thought, Mark, it's a little long, but Mark Wayne Mullen talked about this. This is supposed to be for people who are disabled or impoverished, cutting.
What I'm saying is how do you explain that we only have 35, I say or only, I don't want to use that as a derogatory term, but I just want to use the numbers here. There's 35 million people under the poverty line inside the United States, and there's 70 million people that are signed up for Medicaid. Where are you going to tell me that there's not room to cut fraud, waste, and abuse in the program? People that are today eligible for it underneath current programs are still going to be eligible for it tomorrow, too. We're just getting out the ones that should never be there. I mean, what is so hard about requiring an able-bodied individual with no dependents, no sickness, to work 20 hours a week? I know you work more than 20 hours this weekend alone. What is so hard about having a work requirement there with someone that has no medical condition and no dependents? We don't pay people in this country to be lazy. Yeah.
I mean, it's true. And I think it goes back to the point that Mark Wayne Mullins from Oklahoma was making initially. The math is not math. And look, I come from that generation. My mom had me when she was pregnant with me at 16, had me at 17. We were in poverty. This is not about hating poor people. This is about making sure people are willing and able to work. And if you have the work requirement there, I don't understand how anyone can be against that portion. Also, if there's 35,000 or 35 million that are under the poverty line or at that line, I don't understand where are all these other people coming from? Is that illegals being on there? Is these are people that the state They don't qualify, but the state is still putting them on the roll call. Like, that has to be explained.
Yeah, and they got people on multi-states getting paid from multi-states. Let's say you work one place
That's
and
another
you live another.
Point.
So Elon Musk puts out this. The latest Senate draft bill will destroy millions of jobs in America and cause immense strategic harm to our country. Utterly insane and destructive. It gives handouts to industries of the past while severely damaging industries of the future. So the question is, that is not helpful. The president is not, didn't get mad at him when was asked about this. And obviously his influence diminished. Here's what Kristen Welker said to Mark Waymon. I just thought his answer is so worth going over. Cut seven.
Senator, I hear what you're saying about Elon Musk. Back in February on this program, you called Elon Musk, quote, the best entrepreneur we've ever had in our lifetime.
And I mean that.
Okay, so why would you dismiss his perspective, Senator?
Well, I used to be in business full time is what I did. I was never in politics. I thought I understood politics until I got in it. When I got into it, I realized, whoa. First thing I do is learn how to take a big, deep breath and realize I have to accept other people's opinion. That's what negotiating is. And then when you finally marry the two and you think, well, politics, I guess, kind of does work like business because you have to negotiate business deals. You have to negotiate different personalities, though, here in the Hill. And so you may not ever get a perfect bill, but you get a good bill.
So he's just trying to say, look, the genius has no idea what compromise is.
Yeah, he's also saying that Elon Musk is used to being the dominant person and the final decision maker in the room. That's not the case in politics. No matter how much weight, even the leaders of the House and the Senate have to have some compromise because you're dealing with people from 50 states, 435 congressional districts. It's complicated.
Yep. Let me we'll take a time out so we come back and talk about this mayor's race. This guy, Zohran Mamdani, is the scariest candidate that I have seen since the time I've been at Fox. I'll explain.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I want to ask you about an issue that has divided some New Yorkers in recent weeks. You were recently asked about the term globalize the intifada, if it makes you uncomfortable. In that moment, you did not condemn the phrase. Now, just so folks understand, it's a phrase that many people hear as a call to violence against Jews. There's been a lot of attention on this issue. So I want to give you an opportunity to respond here and now. Do you condemn that phrase, globalize the intifada?
That's not language that I use. The language that I use and the language that I will continue to use to lead this city is that which speaks clearly to my intent, which is an intent grounded in a belief in universal human rights.
Did he answer the question, Lawrence Jones?
No, he didn't answer the question. And the people behind you screaming are saying globalize the intifada. That means suicide bombings. That means shooting Jews. I mean, there's a distinct movement that he's a part of. He was on one of the first protests right after October the 7th. He was there, like 2 weeks right after. So, I mean,
he got arrested.
Not answer.
He got arrested.
He got arrested there at some of the marches.
So that, and how about this? By the way, he tells you right now, I don't like capitalism.
Right.
So this is New York, and this is the city we're stuck in. Cut 26.
You are a self-described democratic socialist. Do you think that billionaires have a right to exist?
I don't think that we should have billionaires because, frankly, it is so much money in a moment of such inequality. And ultimately, what we need more of is equality across our city and across our state and across our country. And I look forward to work with everyone, including billionaires, to make a city that is fairer for all of them.
It's un-American. Plain and simple, it's un-American. And I don't like when people immigrate to this country. He's a new American. They immigrate
from Uganda, originally.
Right. And they come to our country and then want to reshape our country. It doesn't work that way. The principles that he's espousing go against everything that we believe. This is a country where no matter where you come from, you have the opportunity to make wealth and you can build a company to be Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, who came from nothing as well. But saying that you want to take someone else's wealth and redistribute it to other people, I'm sorry, I'm not okay with that.
It's crazy. No billionaire shouldn't exist. So if you come up with a great product like Amazon, you shouldn't be a billionaire? You shouldn't? You know how many people you employed? Do you know how much taxes you bring into the country?
It's insane.
Do you know how you revel and people that invest?
No.
The dividend, does he understand? Well, he understands how capitalism works, and he doesn't like it. How about this? How about race? This is the question that you think that you'd have a better answer to, but no, he doesn't. This is on his website, Cut 28.
We went on your website and realized there's a policy proposal that says your plan, and I'm going to quote it for folks, is to shift the tax burden from overtaxed homeowners in the outer boroughs to more expensive homes in richer and whiter neighborhoods. Explain why you are bringing race into your tax proposal.
That is just a description of what we see right now. No, it's not driven by race. It's more of an assessment of what neighborhoods are being undertaxed versus overtaxed. We've seen time and again that this is a property tax system that is inequitable. It's one that actually Eric Adams ran on saying that he would change in the first 100 days. He's since sought to defend it and lost at every juncture in court.
And I understand you're saying we're simply describing the types of neighborhoods that would see these increase in taxes. And yet, by invoking race, do you run the risk of potentially alienating key constituents?
I think I'm just naming things as they are.
He's literally targeting them because of the rent. Okay, I'll do an example. I want to tax black neighborhoods, mostly black neighborhoods that have high wealth. Okay, what would have been the response to that? People would have said, oh, this guy is racist.
Yeah.
You can't do that. But because you have changed it to white, you get the squirm out of the question. And it's not just that, Brian. He wants to arrest Netanyahu if he comes to New York City.
Yeah.
Now, this is the same guy that says, for New York City, I don't want them cooperating, the police, cooperating with ICE. But you want them to enforce international law, which America does not even recognize, by the way, and arrest Netanyahu. This is who you guys are going to elect.
So Hakeem Jeffries has not endorsed him. Schumer has not endorsed him. Gillibrand has not endorsed him. I really don't know. Chris Murphy thought he was great. Chris Murphy says, "Oh, we could learn a lot from him."
Bill Clinton to congratulate him, but here's the problem, Brian. They're not endorsing, right? But they're congratulating him. And number two, they're not being anti him. Is there any moral clarity within the Democratic Party? This is not what we represent.
I know Senator Fetterman has no problem doing that. I want you to hear this guy.
The only one.
This guy tries, this Democratic strategist, Bernie Sanders' campaign manager, Fazeed Shakir, was on This Week with George Stephanopoulos, who never has him on. Cut 33.
We had a Democratic process play out. People voted. He's the presumptive Democratic nominee. He'll win by a lot. He mobilized young people, mobilized working class people with a message on the affordability crisis that I heard Hakeem Jeffries talking about. So what's the problem? And apparently, I think, from what I understand, the problem is the billionaire class is still opposed to Zoran. They've obviously opposed him during the primary, Bloomberg, Bill Ackman, a whole bunch of people saying that we're going to spend money. And I think they're saying they want to spend money against him in the general. So why are Democratic leaders on the fence? And I think it's because you have too much influence of big dollars. And I hope
too much influence of big dollars. So that's the problem, because big dollars are making Democrats not go behind him. And that's a Democratic strategist.
It shouldn't be just about big dollars, though. It has to be about your principles. The guy doesn't like Jewish people. How many times does he have to say it? I mean, he's with the people chanting in the street. He wants wealth redistribution. He's not going to improve health. He wants to defund the police. We already tried that experiment, and the city was on fire. Mm. I mean, some of this, the Democrats have to look at the past election and say, you know what? I'm going to stand with the American people.
All right, you're going to be substituting for Will Cain today,
4 p.m. 4 o'clock.
All right, Lawrence Jones, thanks so much, Lawrence.
See you.
We have coming up next, Scott Brown. Don't move.
Thanks for listening. Do you like true crime podcasts? If so, check out Unsolved with James Patterson. Listen ad-free on Amazon Music or just say, Alexa, play the podcast Unsolved with James Patterson on Amazon Music.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This was to make sure that the highest, most wealthy Americans can get an extra tax break. And as you just saw on your Chiron there, it adds $4.5 trillion to the debt. I think many of my Republican friends know they're walking the plank on this, and we'll see if those who've expressed quiet consternation will actually have the courage of their convictions.
This guy who's pretending to be outraged and keeps saying things like a tax cut for billionaires, which is not true, by the way, he's a multimillionaire, which he deserves credit for that. But it is. What they did is they cut the top tax rate by 1 point. 1 point. And then they took the corporate tax rate and made it more competitive. Still, Trump would want to get it lower, but he's not going to worry about that now. Corporate tax rate and make it competitive to help bring businesses home. They began to come back, and then the pandemic hit. So all this tax restructure that they are complaining about has been in place. Nothing's changed. And they had the job for 4 years with the House and Senate for two, and they never touched it. Why not? Joining us now to discuss that and so much more is former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, former ambassador to New Zealand, and now he wants to be the next senator from New Hampshire. Scott Brown, welcome back.
Well, listen, I am jealous of you getting to go up in the top of the Statue of Liberty. Are you kidding me? How cool is that?
Yeah, got into the torch with Doug Burgum. I have a feature. You can see it online. It's really cool. Me and the Interior Secretary were able to beat the tourists to the tower.
Yeah, he's a great guy. I'm glad he's there.
So what are your thoughts? First off, on what we just played, from what you know of the Big Beautiful Bill, and it's 940 pages. I know you didn't read all of it, but from what you know, is this something conservative Republicans should be signing off on?
Well, yes, it should be, because what's the alternative? They have an opportunity right now through the Voterama to go in and fight for their amendments. If they're concerned about things, they can go and fight. That's what the process is all about. So you have a choice. It's either nothing, and then you have the 68%, give or take, tax increase. You don't have no tax on tips, no tax on overtime. The border agents don't get $1 billion. You know, you have all those things that click in. Or you fight and you try to get the best possible bill. And that's what I suggest that they do, because you're right. You referenced it in your opening. The Democrats had that opportunity and they did nothing. And that's kind of the answer. Do you do nothing, whether it's on anything, saving money, finding savings, getting rid of fraud, you know, streamlining, consolidate. So that's the answer. Do nothing. No, this is not only good for New Hampshire. It's good for the country. And we have an opportunity to go back. They can go back and work on things that they don't like. I mean, that's the process. But you have a choice. You're either going to do the people's business and do the sausage making and be part of the solution or not.
So the other big story is what's happening in the Middle East. We know Ron Dermer is going to be coming over to visit the president today and an IDF commander. And they're talking about getting towards closer to a peace deal with Gaza, a ceasefire deal with Gaza. But the ramifications and the quality of the hit is still being debated. Rafael Grossi of the IAEA was on over the weekend, Face the Nation. Here's what he says is left now. Cut 13.
Up until these strikes, Iran was still disclosing information to the IAEA in certain amounts.
Well, there were deficits. There were deficits. There were some things that they were not clarifying to us. Mm-hmm. But our inspection work was constant, in particular in this sensitive area of the number of centrifuges and the amount of material. We had perfect view. We didn't have view on other things that we wanted to have, but on this one, it was complete. It was comprehensive. And of course, at the moment, there is nothing.
Right. Deficits. And there were some things. We don't have a perfect view. He's got to be, he's not an investigator. But look, he let this program to grow. And the only reason we found out about Natanz, was the MEK, which was the dissident group that wants back into Iran. That wasn't even found by the IAEA.
Yeah, listen, Brian, it was courageous what the president did. We all know that presidents, since the bombing of our embassy, this taking of hostages, wanted to deal with Iran, and they didn't do it. They didn't have the tools and resources and, quite frankly, the intestinal fortitude to do it. And he did it. And what did the Democrats do? Well, they filed impeachment and had a vote on it. You have here in New Hampshire, obviously, the New Hampshire delegation, Gene Shaheen, Chris Pappas, they wanted to bring it to Congress. Well, they didn't do that with Obama when he dropped dropped 26,000 bombs on countries and went after bin Laden. They didn't do it with JFK and the Bay of Pigs. Thomas Jefferson, 1801, with the Barbary Pirates. I mean, they have that authority. That's why we made them the commander-in-chief. And so, yeah, I'm very thankful. Of course, Iran is going to, like, do the rope-a-dope. I mean, you had Mike Tyson on, rope-a-dope. That's what they were doing with all the entities who are responsible for verifications, and they never should have been given the authority to do what they were doing. So I'm glad he did it, and, you know, it's going to really create a whole new opportunity in that region because the bully is no longer the bully.
Senator Tom Tillis said, not running for re-election. President was not happy, didn't vote for this bill. He goes, okay, I'm not going to run for re-election. So then he went up and he ripped the bill. Do you understand his frustration? And do you worry that you're going to get as frustrated when you get in there for various reasons? Because it is such a slow, deliberative body.
Well, listen, I've been an assessor, selectman, state rep, state senator, U.S. senator, and a U.S. ambassador. Yeah, I know the sausage making, and I was there for only, 3 years, and I worked that very, very hard. And everybody listening hates the fact that Nancy Pelosi and all these other people are now multimillionaires. She's worth $400 million and making $1.79 or $1.85 for salary. Yeah, I did the insider trading bill, and it passed, did it in record time, and when I left, they weakened it. So, yeah, I understand the process. I also understand the frustration. So what do? Just say, I quit? No, you go in and you dig deep and you get coalitions and you go and do the people's business. That's what our founding fathers wanted. They wanted you to go and take a little time and actually figure out, especially in the Senate. It's not like the House where it's, you know, you can just bang things out. The Senate is that deliberative body to do that check and balance, say, whoa, wait a minute. We don't want to keep going up and down. You know, that's why I'm running for the Senate. I understand that process. And if people want to get involved, they can go to scottbrown.com right now and learn more and help. Because you need problem solvers up there, Brian, and Tom's a good man. I know him, but I understand his frustration. But, you know, whatever. You know, next person up.
So what did you learn from your three races?
Well, listen, I learned that New Hampshire is obviously a great state. It's where I'm from. I was born at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. I also learned that Massachusetts is a great state as well, and I was honored to serve. And you know that when I ran the first time, Obamacare was the issue, and people just didn't want the federal government taking away their doctors, and they lied. Well, it's no different here. You have the delegation here lying about Joe Biden's mental health, and you and I called it like 5 years ago. He swore me in. Now, the open border. Borders, the sanctuary cities, you know, not even standing up for a 10-year-old, and yet they're clapping for the gangbangers in El Salvador and protecting them so they don't get out of here. And something that resonates here big time is the men and boys and women and girls sports and locker rooms. That's ridiculous. And Chris Pappas, who I'm running against, is all in. So there are so many things that are kind of upside down, and what I've learned is that you have to use that shoe leather and go look him in the eye, and in New Hampshire especially, hey, you got to vote for Scott Brown. Yeah, I like him a lot. I got to meet him 3 or 4 more times.
Right.
So that's what we're going to do.
So you can blanket the whole state.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'd started about a year ago, and I've been working pretty hard at a busy weekend. And every day it's a busy day. And, you know, listen, the people deserve that. They deserve the opportunity to look me in the eye and ask me any and all questions. The federal delegation, you know, the Chris Pappas, he comes back and, oh, I'm a moderate. I voted on, with the Republicans. Yeah, maybe on a couple of things, but, you know, not on the things that matter. They just had a vote, Brian, you probably know this, if an illegal alien's convicted of drunk driving, you can get him right out of the country. And, you know, the delegation voted against it. Like, why would you vote against something like that?
Don't know. Kelly Ayotte winning the governor's mansion, does that give you a sense that maybe New Hampshire wants to stay a Republican?
Well, we have a Republican governor, House, Senate, and executive council, and for the last 10 years, the federal delegation has been Democrat. But people don't really check their records. They don't check the fact that they're just wrong. Those 80-20 issues, they're on the 20. And I'm going to point that out to the citizens of New Hampshire and make them understand that, hey, listen, can't we just have one person? And especially because President Trump's going to be there for 2 more years, so New Hampshire would have no juice. So I think it would be helpful to have a Republican there, you know, someone who cares very deeply about solving problems.
Has Scott Brown, has the president got behind you?
He's a little busy, Brian. But the team certainly knows that I'm out there, and, you know, and the time's right, we're going to get down there and talk to him, certainly. But, you know, we have a tremendous amount of support from a lot of, I mean, Mark Wayne Mullen endorsed me, a lot of the senators already, and people that matter. But more importantly, the people in New Hampshire are lining up in droves, and that's really great.
So do you have, will you have a primary challenge?
I haven't heard of one. You know, I'm not anticipating. I'm going to run, you know, hard right now, right at Chris Pappas. And just, he's a nice guy, but I'm just going to point out the things that, you know, we differ on, which is pretty much everything. So, yeah, it's fun. It's important. And, you know, I'm 65 years old, Brian, and, you know, I've been a soldier, a father, grandfather, senator, ambassador. You know, I'm not looking for another title. You know, Chris Pappas is, you know, I'm looking for a strong America. And I want this America to be the greatest place in the world, because when I was the ambassador in New Zealand, Cook, Niue, and Samoa, and our interest in Antarctica, every single time I came home, I was so blessed in recognizing that we live in the greatest country in the world, and we are back, and we're hitting our stride. You can see that Daddy's doing a good job, and, you know, he's getting respect all over the world and solving problems and trying to get peace deals. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, I know Chris Coons, a Democrat, actually came out and said the president had a successful NATO summit. And he might be coming around on Ukraine. What do you hope the president does in Ukraine?
Well, listen, it's a very difficult situation, obviously. We can't let Russia continue to, you know, dominate and really go after innocent civilians. That's one where the president's going to have to really, really, I think, focus once we get the, obviously, he did Iran. Now he's looking at, you know, Gaza. I mean, listen, Hamas should just give those people over. Had they done that, we'd never be in this situation. They'd probably still be in some type of power. And I think once Gaza's over, he really needs to focus on, you know, getting those two people together and, obviously, Zelensky and Putin, and get this done, because it's not good for the entire world, quite honestly.
Scott Brown, best of luck. Senator from Massachusetts wants to be the senator from New Hampshire. He's done everything else. And certainly you'd love to go in there as a majority. And it looks as though the Republicans will hold a majority. But having seats like yours flip would be key. Senator Scott Brown, thanks so much. Best of luck.
Hey, everyone, have a great and safe 4th of July. Go to scottbrown.com. Thanks, Brian. God bless. Bye-bye.
Okay, go get him. 1-866-408-7669. When we come back, I'm going to talk about what Larry Kudlow told me on Sunday night on One Nation about why the president doesn't have more trade deals done. Don't move.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
What the holdup is they don't want to give what we want. I mean, the holdup is you have to cut a good deal to get it past the president, who is very sharp on these issues because he's been looking at it for at least 10 years. So the European Union is a good example. They know full well that Jameson Greer, the special trade rep today, and Howard Lutnick really have a little more play over there. Doesn't mean that Scott Bessent won't get involved, but they know who they're negotiating with. Tariffs are a big issue with the European Union. An even bigger issue is non-tariff barriers. There are all these regulations about fish and fowl and meat and air, climates, and all kinds of things they throw at you.
So Larry Kudlow came out and said there's a reason why we have not had a bunch of deals. Like, he wants a really good deal everywhere. India and Pakistan, India was ready to go. And they say that they do not like the president talking about the India-Pakistan deal and trade being involved with it. It hurts him domestically. That delayed some things. Also, they say India is very protective of their market, and they have to open it up. President says, we need access to your market. With Japan, they don't want to buy our cars. He said, it's about time you took some American cars. So that's sold up there. And then in Canada, they wanted to tax our social media and tech companies. The president says the deal is off. They quickly turn around and said, okay, no. Canada said we will scrap the digital services tax. So the president's focusing on steel and aluminum, autos, copper, lumber, semiconductors, jet engines, and pharmaceuticals. That's who he's going to hit tariffs with if there's no deal. He also has a plan for that. He says, if I can't get deals, And look, I hear that India is coming up, but let's say it doesn't happen. Cut 45.
It's so simple. We're sending letters out. I'd rather do it now. My guys, hey, I have great guys, Scott, Howard, other people, Jameson. They're talking to all these countries. We made a deal pretty much with India. We made a deal with China. We made a deal with UK, great people. We made deals. But I'd rather just send them a letter, a very fair letter, saying, congratulations, we're going to allow you to trade in the United States of America. You're going to pay a 25% tariff or 20% or 40 or 50%. I would rather do that.
And he wants to get trade and manufacturing back here. And he says, if things are too expensive, we'll have to make it ourselves and then it'll make more sense. And for those people that say, well, you know what, the president and these tariffs are going to destroy the economy. Did you see the market over 44,000 all-time high? This prominent Wall Street economist who slammed President Trump's tariffs in the Wall Street Journal, obviously, earlier this year, now says the president may have, quote, outsmarted all of us, close quote, with the controversial trade policies. The guy's name is Torsten Slok. He's the chief economist and investment giant, Apollo Global Management. He said that while the uncertainty surrounding trade policy has already started to weigh on the economy, Trump could lower tariffs on most of the U.S. trading partners while using levies to boost federal revenue. Slok suggested a recently posted analysis that the administration's approach may be more strategic than previously thought. The optimistic outlook stands in stark contrast to our earlier position. So, number one, I appreciate in real time people saying that, not after trade deals are done. None have really been done except the UK and the framework for China. Number three is he sees what's happening. I think they got $60 billion since Liberation Day in April. So the money is coming in. So if you want to get that revenue up and get the GDP higher, which would get the deficit lower, that's one thing you can do. When you get higher revenues, you can do more stuff. So he's saying we're still trading. Inflation hasn't budged and we're getting money from the tariffs. I would like to see a long-term deal that helps trade, helps markets, helps people grow, helps those products continue to flourish. But we'll see. So I understand it. Scott Bessent is going to be in studio on Fox and Friends tomorrow. I was supposed to get an interview with him, too, for this show. And I wouldn't think he's going to be here unless he had something to announce or some trade deals on the threshold. The other thing is, you know, the big, beautiful bill will probably pass on Wednesday. So we'll talk about maybe he'll probably know by Tuesday or today if it's going to pass the Senate. So it'll be interesting. And maybe he has some trade deal progress to talk about. President's driving a hard deal everywhere, especially with our allies, with the VAT tax in Europe and everything we get, everything that goes over there, they get an automatic tax on. How do you quantify that? We don't do that here. Well, the EU doesn't seem to want to work with us. Hey, go to BrianKilmeade.com. Find out how to see me in Dallas, Texas in August and Richmond, Virginia in September.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening. Our chance to talk about what's happening locally before we get to the national thing. We have this hour, we're going to be joined by Michael Goodwin, who's standing by in New York with this craziness with this mayoral election. Barney and Company will do a simulcast, and John Cassavetes at 34 after. He was brought up on Meet the Press yesterday by this mayor who wants to make sure the city runs the supermarkets, or at least some supermarkets, and he wants to outlaw billionaires. Let's get to the big three.
Number three. Do you condemn that phrase, globalize the intifada?
That's not language that I use. The language that I use and the language that I will continue to use to lead this city is that which speaks clearly to my intent, which is an intent grounded in a belief in universal human rights.
That means he never answered the question, which means he thoroughly supports it. Pay attention. Zohran Mamdani is the scariest candidate to win a primary. He hates billionaires, marginalizes white people, despises capitalism, wants to defund the police, hates Israel, and perhaps all Jews. And it gets worse from there. But yet, he's the favorite to win the mayorship.
Number two.
They have to say for the first time, the Iranian regime, we recognize Israel's right to exist, but we recognize Israel has the right to exist as a people, the state of Israel does. If they can't say that, you're never going to get a deal worth a damn.
Senator Lindsey Graham, wait and see. Iran has a turning point. Or is this the region about to hit the boiling point? We have the aftermath of the president's impressive strike on Iran as it prepared to ramp down in Gaza. Israel is now saying there's an opportunity for a ceasefire.
Number one.
All these cuts, all this cutback on health care to provide the wealthiest in our country, a disproportionate share of tax cuts, that just doesn't seem fair. And the more we can get that out, I think this will be a political albatross.
Senator Mark Warner, how insincere. The big, beautiful bill going through a brutal confirmation process in the voter-orama. It has begun. We're going to tell you where we're at, what's in it, at stake, President Trump's entire economic agenda. We look at the latest on the trade deals as Canada backtracks. And let's bring in Michael Goodwin. Michael, I was truly horrified but enlightened that sometimes when people have candidates and they make some extreme positions, they say, well, that was crazy. I was youthful. I overspoke or I misspoke. This guy, with a smile on his face, says the most vile things, but yet 400,000 plus New Yorkers thought he was the best Democratic candidate. Can you make sense of this with all your years working this New York beat?
Good morning, Brian. No, it is hard to describe the insanity that is around his campaign. Look, he's can be a quite charming fellow. He's got a level of charisma that nobody else in the race had. He ran a really good race. I mean, he turned out young people. I mean, some of the statistics are mind-boggling. I mean, people, young voters, twice as many as before. And they all voted, many of them voted early, which means he not only attracted them, he turn them out. And I mean, that's the wish of every candidate in every race. But as you say, that, you know, behind that smile, that charming smile, is a heart full of hate. I mean, it is no other way to describe these policies. That when he says, I don't use the phrase globalize the intifada, that's not the standard that we judge someone's competency on and their true feeling. If you can't denounce it, then you support it. I mean, that's just so obvious.
He does.
Deduction. And even what strikes me most about this, Brian, the Democratic leaders keeping him at arm's length. You saw Hakeem Jeffries, the House Minority Leader, another New Yorker, on television yesterday. They are refusing to endorse him because they know he will just take the party. He will become the symbol of the party for Republicans, for President Trump, and he will lead the party over the cliff. They have gone right up to it. But if they embrace this guy and his anti-Semitism and his socialism, they're a party that's, I think, lost for a generation at that point.
So listen to what he says about billionaires. Cut 26.
You are a self-described democratic socialist. Do you think that billionaires have a right to exist?
I don't think that we should have billionaires because, frankly, it is so much money in a moment of such inequality. And ultimately, what we need more of is equality across our city and across our state and across our country. And I look forward to work with everyone, including billionaires, to make a city that is fairer for all of them.
He's in the wrong country. He's in the wrong country.
Yeah, I hope so. Right? I mean, look, he won. As I say, all these voters who turned out for this nonsense, it's not like it's a surprise. I mean, he was saying most of this stuff all along and has been for a year. This idea of government-run grocery stores, that, you know, equality. He said in his victory speech, I want to make New York affordable for every single person. Now, think of that. I mean, that's insane. Affordable for it. So you can come from anywhere in the world, and we have an obligation to make it affordable for you. I mean, he's talking about levels of giveaways that we've never heard before. I mean, this is flat out socialism, and he will drive people out of New York who can afford to escape, because this is going to become a hellhole if he becomes mayor.
It's amazing, but it's really going to be bad for white people. He does not back off that at all.
Right.
He's outraged Jewish people. So Hakeem Jeffries says, I need clarity on that. Kristen Gillibrand, he says, I haven't met him yet. Kristen Gillibrand doesn't look like she's going to endorse him. Schumer says, congratulations. So I don't know if you're going to stop him at this point. And then what's going to happen? Al Sharpton accepted him, even though the black vote went to Cuomo. So what's the strategy here? Get behind Eric Adams, get behind Curtis Sliwa. What is it, Michael?
Well, Brian, I think we'll know a little bit more tomorrow when the results of the election become final. And what that means is there's this ranked choice process. And we will know tomorrow how many votes he actually got. He clearly, in the first counting of, you know, people's first choice, he won decisively over Andrew Cuomo and a large field of others. But now we're going to get into the ranked choice process. And I think that will determine really the size of his constituency and what he can count on. He got, as you said, more than 430,000 votes directly. We'll see how many of the followers of other candidates he also achieved in this crazy process of ranked choice. And then I think we'll see the full scope of the challenge in front of Andrew Cuomo, who said he is going to stay on the ballot on a minor line that he created just for this situation. You have a Republican candidate. You will have the incumbent Eric Adams running as an independent. So you will have effectively four choices, four well-known people at that point on the general election ballot. Now, if you take the 100% and you divide it by four, it's not impossible that any of them could win. I think, and there will be a lot of focus on him. I think we'll probably learn more things about his past sayings and actions and things like that. So there's a long way to go before he gets to City Hall, thankfully.
Right. I just said he's embracing it. He's not running from any of it. He didn't deny any of it. He got arrested protesting against Israel October 8th. Think about that. So yesterday, let's just pivot, if I can, to over in Iran and the decision the president made to blow up their three major nuclear sites. And overall, Israel hit 12, hit the rest, and hit most of the ones we hit. We just hit it with bigger bombs. So they're trying to spin it now that, well, it might have been a good hit, but we could have just had a better deal. We just stayed in the old deal. Listen to Senator Chris Coons, Cut 19.
But what I think the administration has to do next is come forward to Congress with the most complete picture our intelligence community can give us of what happened, of what's going to happen next, and of what their strategy is. I'll just note that President Trump, by press accounts, is now moving towards negotiation and offering Iran a deal that looks somewhat similar to the Iran deal that was offered by Obama. Tens of billions of dollars of incentives and reduced sanctions in exchange for abandoning their nuclear program.
By the way, that is totally not true. Trump just said they flatly denied any talks with Iran, lashed out at Chris Coons, who claimed the administration might be opening up an Obama-style deal. You idiot. The Obama-style deal allowed enrichment in country at 3.4%. They did not allow on-site inspections on three or four major sites. Even the IAEA says we had no access, and the IAEA never found the Natanz plant. It was MEK that found the Natanz plant. How could you possibly claim that Obama had the deal in place would have been the same thing that Trump wants to do? I mean, that's a spin I think is impossible to digest, but I keep hearing it.
Well, yeah, and look, Brian, at what the Obama deal gave the Iranians. It by loosening the sanctions and sending them pallets of cash, it enabled them to fund
yes.
Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, the Houthis. All of that is a direct result of them having the money. They are a terror state, a messianic terror state. And until they change that, you cannot trust them either with the money or the weaponry. And Obama foolishly trusted them with both. And that's why you needed to go in and clean it up again. But I want to say something about Coons, Brian, because every time you see a Democrat on television these days, my view is, what are they trying to do except find some foothold, any foothold, for the Democratic Party
to resist Trump on. They have tried everything. I mean, we were just talking about the mayoral race in New York. Mamdani is one of those people looking for a foothold against Trump. And they're getting, in my view, crazier and crazier. They're making up more stuff. They're reaching. Chuck Schumer accused the Big Beautiful Bill of being unlike any other bill in the history of America, because Republicans are trying to hide the cost and use gimmicks to get it passed. What? I mean, unlike anything in the history of the country? I mean, they are desperate to find some foothold that the public can rally around. And unable to do it in the real world, they've taken to fiction. They've taken to Mamdani's. They're taken to Bernie Sanders, to AOC, to Rashida Tlaib. This is now the point, the arrow of the spearhead of the Democratic Party is the crazies who are seizing this vacuum of leadership and to say to the public, here, we've got a new brand, a new party, a new idea. And it's making all of them look foolish. And so far, there's no evidence that the public is buying any of this. But it just shows how desperate they are to come up with some way of defeating Donald Trump, because they can't do it on the merits. They can't do it straight ahead. They can't do it on the issues. He has crafted a position that is practically unassailable from the left, because they had their chances. They blew it. They went too far. And a lot of them know it, but they don't know how to come back without looking as if they're surrendering to Trump. But I think that's the only way back at this point. They've got to come around on issues like transgender, you know, men in women's sports, the taxes, the indoctrination in schools, all of these things, the strong military, right, the absence of woke in the culture. I mean, all of these things that they built into the system they controlled are coming undone. The anti-Semitism on campuses, they did nothing about it. So I think the Democrats are really still at sea, and anything that they, any idea that they found their way back, I think is vastly.
Well, number one, on the anti-Semitism, major progress. Harvard, Yale, Columbia, now the University of Virginia president outs because of DEI, and who knows what was involved with that. George Washington University has been widely condemned. They're getting pressure everywhere. I think Linda McMahon, I thought, wow, kind of a weird position. You got to just kind of gradually put yourself out of business. Instead, it's been one of the most consequential positions in the administration. She's cracking down everywhere with the agenda not to tell the schools what to teach, but not to leave out a well-rounded education and not to tolerate any intolerance on campus, like against Jews. But anybody would have to note the week the president had. Ceasefire between Israel and Iran. Drives plan for NATO allies to revamp their defense spending accepted. Confirms talks with Iran next week. Thursday, Nestle joins growing list of companies implementing the MAHA practices. They're getting dyes out of foods. It's like nine other major companies that have done the same. Friday, the Supreme Court victory, the stock market hits real record highs. And then Saturday, the beginning of the passage of the procedural vote to allow the voterometer to take place, where they got 51 votes in the Senate. So if anyone thinks the president's not on a roll, they're not paying attention, or they just don't want to see it.
Completely agree, Brian. That and you know, the other side of the coin is that Democrats have no way to stop it. I mean, what are they going to do? Defend the anti-Semitism on campus? I mean, are you going to always take the opposite position? You know, you're the opposition party. I get that, but sometimes the opposite position is you can't take it, and that's the position that they're in. So they have no position. I mean, just think what we're talking about, the anti-Semitism. Yeah. Have you heard a single Democrat support this?
Nope.
I mean, it's extraordinary, right? He is the president and his team are cleaning up a rot, a vile rot that has been allowed to fester for a generation or more.
Gotcha.
And the Democrats don't have a thing to say about it.
But,
I mean, it's extraordinary how deeply off track they are.
Michael Goodwin, thanks so much. Check him out in the New York Post. Back in a moment, Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Free, free! Free, free! Free, free!
All right, but have you heard this one, though? Death, death to the IDF! 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 Death, death to the IDF!
So that is this guy, Bob Villain. He was, this was aired on the BBC, the Glastonbury Music Festival. And he breaks into this. And by the way, it didn't sneak up on anyone. You could hear him winding up for this. And I'm sure he said this stuff before. If you look at the crowd, there's Palestinian flags flying everywhere. In a performance Saturday afternoon, the front man started screaming death to the IDF. Thousands in the crowd joined him, as you heard. This is the festival's main stages and the broadcast and broadcast live on the BBC. And they admit in retrospect, they should have stopped it, Allison.
In retrospect, they should have pulled down the stream. Yes.
Yeah. So how they not know this guy's agenda when people walk in with Palestinian flags, it's OK. All right. That's fine. Really snuck up on you, too. So, by the way, anyone, and I'm looking at Ezra Klein, they say a sober Democrat who has a pathway to the future. He says he didn't vote for Cuomo simply because Cuomo went after Mamdani for being anti-Semitic. You crazy? You don't want to be cowed. That is anti-Semitic. He says, I'm for a two-state solution. You know who's not for a two-state solution? The Palestinians. They want one state without Israel. That's fundamentally the problem.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
John Castamatidis, who runs Christie's grocery chain, you're probably very familiar with him. He said this on Election Day, quote, if the city of New York is going socialist, I will definitely close or sell or move or franchise the Gristides locations. In order to run New York City successfully as mayor, do you not need the support of a billionaire businessman like John Castamatidis?
I don't know if I need his support specifically, but I want to make clear that my vision for this city is a vision for every single New Yorker, including business leaders across the city. And the reason I say that is that my proposals, even the ones to increase the top corporate tax rate of New York to match that of New Jersey, are ones that would also benefit those business leaders.
So here we go. That was the controversial, seemed to be presumed, Democratic nominee Zohran Mamdani, who came out and let everybody know that he, one of his great ideas was to have a supermarket run by the city. He says it's been very successful in other places. Well, when you own Gristides or if you own a supermarket or even a deli, how do you feel about that? The city running a supermarket to run you out of business because they're pretty much nonprofit? Also, what makes you think they can run a supermarket? And guess whose name was brought up? John Castamatidis, who among his many jobs is he also owns Red Apple Media, which runs WABC, which is kind enough to carry our show every day. John, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Brian. And, you know, I have to laugh about it because it doesn't work anywhere in the world. It looks like he wants to be the next Fidel Castro. I've been to Cuba. You know, Fidel Castro has done the same thing, promised people everything. And this is what the Z-Man is doing. He wants to be Zorro. I saw that movie. You know, it doesn't work. But we've been to Cuba 30 years ago, and Fidel Castro promised everything to the people, and that he's going to get rid of the millionaires in those days, and the people will thrive. Well, when we were in Cuba in the 1990s, I was down there with Curtis, I was down there with Congressman Rangel, and guess what? The people of Cuba were starving to death. I went to the medical school with Congressman Rangel, and there were some kids there from Brooklyn Tech High School where I went in Brooklyn. And guess what? I said to them, what can I do to help you? You know, fellow Brooklyn Tech High School kids. They said, please send food.
Wow.
Guess what? The people in Havana were starving, empty shelves in the supermarkets in Havana. And that's what Zolman wants to do. He wants to be the next Fidel Castro. The other thing that Zolman wants to do is he wants to nationalize some of the companies in New York. Well, it doesn't work. The other thing Zolman wants to do is freeze rents. Well, if you freeze rents and the people who own it cannot pay the mortgage, the banks are going to foreclose on it. Bottom line, what happens, I'm telling all the homeowners, all the condo owners, all the co-op owners, well, if this guy becomes mayor, maybe your real estate will be worth 50%, a half. And Brian, the same thing right after Castro, the same thing happened in Venezuela. Venezuela was the richest country in South America, the richest country. And Hugo Chavez takes over, promising the people everything. Well, Hugo Chavez got rich and became from the richest country in South America, became the poorest country in South America.
And it's getting worse. So listen to me.
It's getting worse. I mean, the Zoram or the Z-Man or whatever you want to call him, he is promising everything. But it doesn't work. Now, I got to remind people something else. He is an assemblyman with five people in his office. What does he know about running anything? Why don't you go make him the CEO of General Motors? I mean, it's crazy. He doesn't have – look, I've never met the guy, but he doesn't have the resume to do it.
What did you think when he brought your name up?
Who do I think?
When Kristen Welker brought your name up. And he's like, well, I know of him, but I, you know, doesn't really think much of him. Then she asked this question, cut 26.
You are a self-described democratic socialist. Do you think that billionaires have a right to exist?
I don't think that we should have billionaires because, frankly, it is so much money in a moment of such inequality. And ultimately, what we need more of is equality across our city and across our state and across our country. And I look forward to work with everyone, including billionaires, to make a city that is fairer for all of them.
How do you feel about that? You're a self-made billionaire.
Brian, Fidel Castro said the same thing. Hugo Chavez said the same thing. Why is people leaving Cuba? Why are people leaving Venezuela? Is anybody breaking into Cuba or breaking in to get into Venezuela? No. What happens is the people of Venezuela got conned. The people of Cuba got conned. And what this guy is trying to do is con the people of New York.
So who's behind
it? And it's not going to happen.
Well, this sounds like the college kids that are causing chaos on campuses. His dad teaches
there. He's from Columbia University, isn't he? Or his parents are at Columbia.
Yeah, his dad teaches at he's a professor at Columbia.
So you're playing a bad movie all over again.
So listen to this question about race. Cut 28.
We went on your website and realized there's a policy proposal that says your plan, and I'm going to quote it for folks, is to shift the tax burden from overtaxed homeowners in the outer boroughs to more expensive homes in richer and whiter neighborhoods. Explain why you are bringing race into your tax proposal.
That is just a description of what we see right now. It's not driven by race. It's more of an assessment of what neighborhoods are being undertaxed versus overtaxed. We've seen time and again that this is a property tax system that is inequitable. It's one that actually Eric Adams ran on saying that he would change in the first 100 days. He's since sought to defend it and lost at every juncture in court.
And I understand. Right,
So he keeps, and she'll bring it up two or three times. He has no regrets of saying, we're looking to tax white people more.
Well, you know, I hate to say, but that's racism. He has an expertise. The Socialist Party is running the Democratic Party right now. And the common sense Democrats have to stand up against them because for some reason, they're getting all the Socialist Democrats, all the Socialists to go and vote in a primary and take control of the Democratic Party. I've been in business for a long time, and you know what I say, Brian? Something smells. How many people, how did they get all these people out? Who provided the money to get it out?
I hear you.
Okay? I think that President Trump, who was on Maria's show on Sunday and called him a communist, I think President Trump should ask the Department of Justice to do a little bit of investigation. Who the hell is this person? Where does he come from? Where did he get his money from? Because I believe that there's something I don't know for sure, but I have a pretty good nose, Brian. I believe the deal smells.
So let's talk about the race specifically. So why did Cuomo lose?
Well, it was 102 degrees that day. Cuomo was supposed to win, but I guess all the common sense people didn't. 102 degrees, they had so much common sense they stayed home.
Yeah.
And the Socialist Party got their vote out. And listen, we can't decide the fate of New York City based on 50, 60,000 votes that day with 102 degrees.
So do you think who has the best chance? I only have a minute left. Who has the best chance to win now?
Right now, it's a toss-up. I think that Curtis, who we love, he's a member of WABC. We love him dearly. Eric Adams, the current mayor of New York, who President Trump pardoned and has a heart for, because Eric Adams is helping President Trump clean out the criminals out of the city of New York. Albany is not going to help anybody. Albany is full of socialists, too. They're not going to help any future mayor. But President Trump and Eric Adams worked together to clean out the city. And you know what I say about Brian? The people in the city of New York, they want the criminals out. And the criminals are hiding, because if they get caught by the feds, they go straight to Guantanamo, do not pass go, do not collect $200. Cuomo is a good leader, too.
All right, John Castamatidis, thanks so much. You're all over the Sunday shows this week. And check him out all over WABC. You can also get him on the stream on WABC.com. Thanks so much. Appreciate it, John. When we come back, simulcast with Stuart Varney on FBN. Don't move.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney and Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everybody. Stuart Varney is going to come on with us in a matter of moments. We'll do a simulcast. You'll get to find out what it's like to be on FBN and listen on your radio while you're driving in your car. We appreciate it. Special thanks to John Castamatidis for joining us. He runs everything at WABC. And that's one of our great affiliates, and happy to be here now. I will be able to take, at the bottom end, I see out there Sandra, Susan, and Ellis. I'll be able to take calls right after this, because Stuart Varney leaves me a little bit of time before we close out the hour. So let's listen together.
0.25%. It's coming up on 10:51 Eastern Time. That means it's time for Brian Kilmeade. Brian, I want you to take a look at this op-ed in the Journal. They're pitching an idea to the Democrats, who are desperate to win back young male voters. They say, lower the drinking age. You think that would work? Would you think young men would vote for the party that lets them drink at 18?
I don't know if you could do that state by state anymore. I guess they could try it. Are they trying desperately to do what Mom Donnie did, which is take the polar plunge in a suit, go around and have rave parties and sponsor them? That's what he did to win them over. So I guess it's a page from what this guy did in order to get the 423,000 votes he needed to win the primary. But I don't know. I remember the age was 18, and then I was legal. Then it went up to 19, and I was illegal. Then I got to 19, they moved it to 21, and then I was illegal for two more years. I don't remember if it affected my vote or not.
But as a parent of teenage youngsters, I was a parent of teenagers many years ago, I can understand the reluctance to raise the drinking age to 21, because you're always worried about your children's survival. In principle, I understand lowering the drinking age, but in practice, it worries me. What say you?
Well, especially you and your background, like when you travel to Australia, you go to England, the big thing that shocks almost every kid is you could drink at any age there. Ireland, And it's just, there's just not that, that sense of we're not allowed. And we're in New York, they're like, what's your age? What's your ID? Let me see. Is that really you? Do you have a backup? So I don't know. It might be a tactic for the Wall Street Journal. I don't know. They're desperate to make sure Mom Donnie doesn't win. Most sober people are.
All right. Some of our most famous athletes are urging President Trump to reform cannabis laws. And that includes boxing legend Mike Tyson. Here's what he told you on Fox and Friends earlier today.
You have to believe cannabis is in the same category as heroin. How do you categorize it with heroin? Anybody that ever smoked cannabis know there's no comparison. And that's just ridiculous. So we're working on making a schedule three and open up safe banking, because there's over 500,000 people that can't get loans because they're in the cannabis business alone. And that's just so ridiculous. It's such a great income of insurance for the country. And I just can't see it. It's ridiculous.
All right, Brian, do you think Trump would support cannabis reform?
I don't know. I know he really respects Mike Tyson. And some of the people that he is asking for the same thing, I know he really respects them. But and I know that if he feels as though that tax dollars have come into the city, it's been a state situation. The problem is the marijuana, I understand today, is much more powerful. And the way to regulate that is to organize it and allow it to be legal. You know, and if you are going to legalize in a state, banks shouldn't be discriminating against you because of the product. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the debanking for Republicans that was taking place in various banks. Oh, you're a conservative. I'm going to debank you. So I guess his point is you're selling marijuana. These banks don't want any part of it. I can understand both sides of it. He wants to make some money, but marijuana has been good for him. He's got chronic depression. And who knows what type of head trauma he's been through. He says it changed his life for the better. He sounds like he uses it for medical purposes. But how I feel personally is that legalizing gambling and marijuana are two things that is just a pure money grab, because there's That's nothing true. Positive about states and the government supporting this.
You toured the Statue of Liberty with Interior Secretary Doug Burgum. Tell us about it.
Pretty amazing in that. You get the history. If you go to the Statue of Liberty, which everyone should do, you don't just show up and go into the Statue of Liberty. There's a museum right there. But the Secretary of Interior said, let's take this tour leading up to the 4th of July. We worked out Saturday. I met him down there at 6 o'clock in the morning. We took a police boat over and we were able to get a great exclusive tour. But instead of just going to the crown, we were able to go down and up over to the torch, which is just a straight up climb that you expect firefighters. The firefighters do it every day, but pretty cool to be up there and experience it. And there's a lot of this 4 million people that go every year. It's also a terror target as well, because people want to be able to take it down. The skin of the Statue of Liberty is the thickness of two pennies, and it is made of copper. Special thanks to the French for doing it. Quick note, the French told us, build a pedestal. We're giving you the statue. We didn't get the pedestal done in time, so we had to leave it in boxes. By the time we were ready to put it together, the numbers and directions had worn off. So we had to call the French back to tell us how to put it back together.
Good story, Brian. Good story. Come back again and tell us it in full. Brian Kilmeade, you're all right. All right, sports fans.
Thanks so much. So this is Dana Carvey having fun with Joe Biden, something that wouldn't have happened if Joe Biden was president, won his reelection.
Do you now that you know that Biden is like severely diminished, do you feel any guilt or
do you, Dana?
Or insight into your portrayal?
Jesus.
Well, that's a good question. This is really good, and we're going to reframe this podcast, the Julie Bowen podcast.
Now, yeah, she's good.
We can flip it. No, but those are great questions.
She's better at it than we are.
I knew that he was compromised mentally. I mean, it was obvious. But it was a delicate thing in the comedy world. There were a lot of people did not want to do anything that would kind of seeing him in like an awkward way.
But it's comedy.
That's it. That's the key. If I can do Biden.
That's the idea. But
if I can make Biden funny to everybody, then I am where I want to be. And to make it funny, it had to be recognizable. Right. And so there are certain things I did not include in my package. The biggest one was this. I'm not kidding around here. I'm being serious.
Yeah.
So that was the biggest one for me.
So they're trying to make him feel guilty?
He's just, she just asked me, basically said, like, there were some things he had to sort of take his time in sort of weaving into his bit because he didn't want to go too far because the comedy world wasn't really ready for it yet.
Right. They weren't ready for it yet. But they didn't do it. They would have killed Trump if they saw any slippage at all. They didn't want to help Trump. That was a big thing.
Fox News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade. Thanks so much for listening. We'll come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. We're usually about six blocks away. They are actually protesting against Israel and for Iran, which is really disheartening, to say the least. We're going to break down the economy with Liz Claman, the host of the Claman Countdown, and the trade deals that haven't come across yet. And David Burke is standing by. He's a Top Gun instructor. Echelon Front is his company now, where he's chief development officer. We've got to use his expertise and what he thinks about the operation before and after, as well as how much damage you think's done and questions he still has to answer. So before we get to Dave, let's get to the big three.
Number three. Do you condemn that phrase, globalize the intifada?
That's not language that I use. The language that I use and the language that I will continue to use to lead the city is that which speaks clearly to my intent, which is an intent grounded in a belief in universal human rights.
Zohan Mamdani, one of the scariest candidates in American political history. He hates billionaires, doesn't like cops, marginalizes white people, despises capitalism, yet he seems to, on the cusp of winning the Democratic nomination, to be mayor of the biggest and most famous city in the world. What is going on?
Number two.
They have to say, for the first time, the Iranian regime, we recognize Israel's right to exist, but we recognize Israel has the right to exist as a people, the state of Israel does. If they can't say that, you're never going to get a deal worth a damn.
Wait and see. Iran at a turning point, or is the region at a boiling point? We have the aftermath of the president's impressive strike as Israel prepares to ramp down in Gaza.
Number one.
All these cuts, all this cutback on health care to provide the wealthiest in our country a disproportionate share of tax cuts, that just doesn't seem fair. And the more we can get that out, I think this will be a political albatross.
Really, Senator Warner? Are you pretending like the big, beautiful bill is that bad? Going through the brutal confirmation process that's happening now with the so-called Voterama. We will tell you where we are at and what's at stake. President Trump's entire economic agenda wrapped up really in one bill. He has two more shots at the reconciliation process. But right now, we're talking about this and trade deals, and that will really set the tone for the midterms. But in terms of the operation, the historic operation, we found out a lot of things last week. I'm talking about the bombing of the three sites. The Tomahawk hits one site, and the two other sites, Natanz and Fordo, were hit by the B-3s and the Bunker Buster bombs. And how detailed it was planned, how long it was in the works, and how well it was pulled off. One of the few people that maybe wasn't surprised about the execution and the scope is my next guest. He's David Burke, Top Gun instructor. Dave, welcome back.
Yeah, it's good to be back with you. Thanks.
So, Dave, what could you tell me about the operation from the professional standpoint?
Well, I got to give you a lot of credit because when we discussed this before it happened, some of the questions you were asking and the way it was described really foreshadowed exactly what was going to happen. It was a extremely well-executed mission, very complex, very complicated, and done almost exactly how we predicted it, and they did a really, really good job.
Would you have been nervous on the mission, or what goes through your mind knowing it's 31 hours once you get in?
I would have killed to have been on that mission. I think I would have been much more excited than nervous, but they were working hard. That's a long mission, a lot of prep getting into it, and a lot of to and from for those relatively short minutes over Iran, but that's a mission I think anybody would have loved to have been on.
So what they aimed for were the vents, right? I mean, the ventilation vents. So they went deep down. Now, we don't know. We don't have cameras down there. Why do you think the CIA and the president and many others are so confident they did tremendous damage?
Yeah, that's the exact question to ask. And I know there's an ongoing debate. Here's why I think it's true. There's two real things to think about when you're evaluating in the aftermath of a strike. And the first one is, did the bombs go where we wanted them to go? Prior to the mission, you get what's called a set of DIMPIs, desired points of impact, meaning this is where we want the bombs to go. Bombs don't always hit where we want. And if you look at where we plan on hitting versus where we're hitting, those bombs went to the locations that we wanted them to go to. So that's the first step in the process. We got to get them in the right place. And two, did the bombs do what we wanted them to do? Sometimes bombs dropped at the wrong angle, skip off the ground and don't detonate. Sometimes they don't penetrate. These bombs all did what they were supposed to do. They all went into the ground, multiple bombs going A, where they're supposed to go, and B, doing what they're supposed to do. And because of that, I'm extremely confident they had the effects that they were looking for.
How important was the deception of all flying together and then certain some B-2s going over to Guam?
Yeah, it's massively important. Anytime you can take an enemy in any environment by surprise or behave in a way that they're unprepared for just creates an advantage for you. And that is the entire intent behind why you have created this incredible stealth technology for B-2s, F-35s, and F-22s.
I want you to hear what Rafael Mariano Grossi said of the IAEA. He's director general. Again, he's not an investigator. He's speculating. Cut 11.
It's clear that what happened, in particular in Fordo, Natanz, Isfahan, where Iran used to have and still has to some degree capabilities in terms of treatment, conversion, and enrichment of uranium have been destroyed to an important degree. Some is still standing. There is, of course, an important setback in terms of those capabilities.
So that's what he assessed. But people have told me, Brian, they're inspectors. You know, they don't look at bomb damage.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be all sorts of speculation. And I think hearing that it's perfectly understandable. First and foremost, the fact that it happened the way that it did isn't just a tactical success for the weapons themselves. It's also a massive strategic victory that if, by the way, we did discover we need to do this again, we have demonstrated not just the capability, but the resolve to do it. And so in more ways than just the tactical success, I think the overall success demonstrates that if for some reason we need to continue to conduct operations to diminish their capability even further, we have the ability to do that.
So, Dave, the other thing to keep in mind, too, is they killed their commanders and they killed 9 scientists, leading nuclear scientists. Who wants to be the 10th? I mean, right? I mean, these are not hardened special operators. They're wearing lab coats. Next thing you know, they're doing their Toyota Prius and they're going to work and they're wondering, is this the day that I get taken out? I mean, the Israelis' intelligence is unbelievable what they're able to pull off. Psychologically, these guys must be saying, or these women, am I next?
That's the exact word I had in mind as you were talking. I think you hit the nail on the head. The psychological component of this is significant. And again, that's why we said there's clearly tactical success here. Weapons went they were supposed to do. They did damage. But the messaging, the strategic capability, the resolve, and then the psychological components, all of those play into the overall outcome that we want to achieve in the long run.
So it's interesting because we said if it happened, if we see them putting it together, would you bomb it again? And Trump said, oh, yeah, I would do it again. But, Dave, you know that they've been a nemesis of ours in all our conflicts and problems for 40 years. So what do you think it does for the military community that we finally took aggressive action? We're always more powerful, but we were always so cautious.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the use of military force is a significant question for any administration to ask. But I think what we've demonstrated is the investment in our ability to do these things with not zero, but incredibly low risk, certainly compared to previous generations, and our ability to collaborate with our allies to send a message of capability, willingness, and then also a significant disparity in our ability to compare to their ability to defend. They can't find us, they can't shoot us, they can't see us. That creates a real problem. And we have demonstrated that, not in theory, we've demonstrated that in practice now. And the world, and certainly Iran, understands that. That, I think, sends a powerful message to the world about our military capability and to our military that we trust their ability to do this.
How surprised are you that the militias in Iraq didn't take action? How surprised are you the Houthis sent one rocket since this whole thing ended? Nothing at the time. And they have not. They did one thing in Qatar at our base, and they gave us 6 hours notice before they shot off ballistic missiles. And we don't hear anything from Hezbollah and Hamas. How, from being that you understand the mindset of the enemy, what do you think they're thinking? Why don't you think they took any action?
I don't think anybody would want to see this happen to them again. This is a demonstration of something that we have not done. We've not used this weapon system and not this capability before. And I think a lot of it is the recognition of, wow, that's an impressive capability, and I don't want any part of that. And so, to be quite frank, I'm not super surprised that they're just essentially doing nothing in response, because I don't think they want anything to instigate another attack like that.
I also think the Israelis are saying, why did you stop us from winning for 40 years? Hezbollah has been Iraq. They're sending rockets. Hamas, the other thing, we just absorb it, stop complaining, work on a two-state solution. After October 7th, it gave them permission to wipe out. They have wiped out every commander, every founder in Gaza, and they've lost 400 guys in doing it, and women. But the people of Gaza's paid a big price, but Hamas paid a bigger price. Hezbollah seems to have gotten the message. This is the, sometimes in this world, even when we pretend we're more civilized, doesn't it seem like aggressive action, willingness to fight, is the key to peace?
Yeah, and associated with the level of competence the Israeli military demonstrated, what they were able to accomplish, how they accomplished it in that relatively short period of time was remarkable. And we leveraged that too. That was one of the tickets to it, allowed us to conduct our mission the way that we wanted, is what Israel was able to do to diminish the capability of the Iranian military. That, I think, sends its own message. And I think them being able to utilize that the way that they did is what they needed to do.
All right, Dave Burke, thanks so much. Appreciate it. And maybe there'll be some more operations for you to break down. Thanks. Appreciate you being with us today.
Call me anytime.
Yeah,
thank you.
Great job. 1-866-408-7669. Now you can call me this time when we get back. And of course, we'll talk about that, the big, beautiful bill, the progress we're making on that bill in the Republican side. If it passes, keep in mind the Votorama today, the vote in the Senate tomorrow, and then the House gets it. And if it's 85% of what the House gave it, it gave to the Senate, I got to feel they're just going to sign off on it. What do you think? Brian Kilmeade Show. Your call's next.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So I had a chance to sit down with Doug Burgum. We actually did it standing up after my Statue of Liberty tour. And we'll have the full interview Sunday night at 10 o'clock. But here's a sneak peek right here on the Brian Kilmeade Radio Show.
One thing that stood out to me when you and I have been speaking is you knew the president well before you got the job, before he won. What are you finding out as being one of his cabinet members about the pace and his approach to the position?
Well, I think you know I've been an entrepreneur most of my life. There's very few times.
You were a tech guy for a while.
I was, but I was always working for myself, you know, as chairman, CEO. I mean, so this is one of the few times I've had a boss, but you couldn't ask for a better leader than President Trump, because it's not just his work ethic, round the clock and hard work, but America should know each one of these executive orders is this secretary shall do X by, you know, in 15 days. I mean, Pete Hegseth.
He signs it, you do it.
Yeah, we do it. And I mean, I was getting these, they're coming every week. You know, we're getting dozens of EOs, and they're all 15 days, 30 days. And then Pete Hegseth got one that was 60 days. I'm like, how do I get one of those, Pete?
get a military. But one of the things you do is you're also in charge of energy. You know, you and Secretary Kelly, I guess, are working.
Secretary Wright.
You and Secretary Wright are in charge of energy. So right now, when it comes to gas prices are down to 2021 levels as we have this holiday season. Does that have anything to do with your approach to this?
Well, absolutely, President Trump. It's another gift to the American people with the lowest gas at the pump prices that this country's had in 4 years. And what a miracle it's happening right when we've just closed out a Middle East war.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, this is normally the time in our history in the last 7 years when that would happen, prices would go through the roof. But because of the strategy of making sure that we've got enough energy for ourselves and to sell to our allies, that's an inflation buster as opposed to an inflation crater. So President Trump created the National Energy Dominance Council ask Chris Wright and I to lead it because he understood it takes a whole of government approach across Commerce, Treasury, EPA, Agriculture, Interior, Energy, all of us working together to make sure that we can have energy to sell to our friends and allies and have enough for prosperity at home and peace abroad. That's what we're doing.
President will call you and say, what about that pipeline in Alaska? What's going on with this governor? He is the detail that you explained to me is mind-boggling, especially considering
he's not calling between 9 and 5. I'm getting those phone calls at 9:45 on a Saturday night after he's been in Saudi Arabia for a week saying, oh, we'll be coming on those pipelines. Right. I mean, this guy works 7 days a week, nonstop. He understands the details, and it's fantastic what he does and how much he cares about the American people. And he understands it right now, but with this AI arms race that we're against China, it's not just about price at the pump. We've got to have enough electricity to drive, you know, all the reshoring, all the manufacturing that's coming back. We've never had an economic developer like President Trump. He's bringing in tens of trillions of dollars to our country. This is a dream for if you're a governor in this country. You've got a guy that's bringing all this capital investment here, but we need electricity to power AI.
And I understand you're doing nukes. Nuclear energy.
Nukes,
first
geothermal, I mean, everything. President Trump signed 4 executive orders around nuclear, and he broke open that market. There's been $1 billion of private capital going into nuclear energy startups in the 4 weeks since he signed those EOs. He's just changing markets and changing trajectory with his vision.
Also, when it comes to trade, we have seen rare earth being held back by China. America does not have, we have rare earth, but we don't mine rare earth. What have you done? That's your responsibility. That's a national security situation. We cannot be dependent on China for rare earth.
It is, our team has been on this, having meetings. A day doesn't go by when Secretary Wright, myself, and others are not meeting with folks that have got plans to develop and process rare earth minerals.
Is it going to take time?
We're on a fast track. This has to be like a Manhattan Project. We can't be dependent on adversaries for things that are essential.
But the problem is you have Democratic governors who don't want to mine in their states.
Well, we've effectively killed mining in this country. I think we graduate over 36,000 lawyers every year, and about 300 kids come out of schools of mining. We've got to get back in the game. And when we do anything, including mining in America, we do it cleaner, safer, smarter than anywhere in the world. So if people care about the environment, they should really have all of those critical minerals, rare earth minerals, developed and processed here in the United States.
Pipeline in Alaska, pipeline in New York, right? You think you got a deal to get a pipeline through New York?
Absolutely. It's moving down the track. And I'll tell you, this week, during that heat dome, we run a razor's edge of having brownouts and blackouts that could have wiped out this whole region. There needs to be more gas to run the electrical plants that are here, provide the power to run New York City and to run New England. The highest electric prices in the country are spread across New England, with the exception of Hawaii, because we don't have enough fuel here to power the electricity needed to run this region.
You also did something that's underappreciated. You turned over as Interior Secretary land to the military to seal our border. The reason why we basically sealed the border is you, as Interior Secretary, said, hey guys, do what you have to do.
Well, listen, you've written a book about Theodore Roosevelt, amazing vision that he had in the early 1900s when he was president. It's called the Roosevelt Reservation. He said, we're going to take a strip of land like 100 feet wide that runs along the whole border. He understood that 41% of that southwestern border is federal land that's part of Interior, and he said, we're going to reserve that.
So that is a little about the interview. You'll see more on Sunday at 10 o'clock. But Doug Burgum gave me not only a tour of Statue of Liberty, but 10 minutes after, to talk about everything that's on his plate and working with President Trump. Liz Claman on the Big Beautiful Bill and the trade deals next.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
But I want to ask you about your colleague, Tom Tillis,
okay,
who voted against it.
Right.
And he said that it contains significant changes to Medicaid that would be, in his words, devastating to North Carolina. Do you respect his view on that? I know you disagree with his vote.
I respect him a lot, but here's what we're doing when it comes to Medicaid. It's grown 50% in 5 years. It's about to take over Medicare. What we've done is we limited the growth of Medicaid to 6% for 2 years. After that, 4% growth. We haven't cut Medicaid. We reduced the growth. And Ted Budd is going to vote for the bill.
So Ted Budd is the other senator from North Carolina. And we'll see. They probably lost Rand Paul. Just wants to sit on the sideline and complain. And then you have Tom Tillis, who's going to vote against it. They'll leave at 51. You always have J.D. Vance. With me right now is Liz Claman, host of the Claman Countdown on FBN. Liz, your thoughts about where we're at right now. House passed it, gave it to the Senate. 85% of the Senate, the House bill is in the Senate bill, but they're still amending it.
It's a whole different process in the Senate, and the amendment process, they call that the votorama because it just goes around and around and around. Anybody can throw out, put out onto the floor an amendment, and it's unlimited. So this is going to take a while. And already you had the 16-hour reading of the entire bill, which everybody should really read it, but that, of course, slowed down the entire process. It was pushed by the Democrats. But, you know, for this one, you need just a simple majority, which should be easier for the Democrats, but it is not.
They
can
only
fold, Republicans, yeah. Yes, correct. They can only afford to lose three Republicans. Two are already no's, as the aforementioned Tom Tillis and, of course, Rand Paul. And then there are a bunch of questions about other people who are very concerned for different reasons, Brian.
Yeah.
Some of the GOP don't like the cuts to Medicaid and to SNAP. They don't think that passes the smell test with the people in their state. And others feel it's too costly, like the Rick Scotts of the world. They want to see more cuts.
But Ryan Johnson says he's on board with it, and Rick Scott thinks he's going to get a cut when it comes to Medicaid because he knows hospitals so well. So he offered an amendment. John Thune says, I back that. Then I talked to Senator Banks. He says, I back it too, but I'm not sure it has the votes. But I like guys or women that say, okay, I don't like it. I'm going to try to fix it. I mean, I have no patience for people who just say, well, it's not what I want to do.
Well,
don't tell me it's all compromise. Did someone elect you president or congressman or senator? Unless you even a president compromises all the time.
Well, in any good negotiation, both sides walk away slightly annoyed.
Yeah.
It's called compromise. There was actually a bit of a compromise on SALT. So they gave in to the 40% cap for 5 years, and then it resets to 10%. These are for the state and local tax deductions for high-tax states. It will reset after the 5 years for the next 5 years, so to 10%. That's called compromise. Okay, you get a little bit of what you want. I get a little bit what I want.
Right.
That was a good sign to me.
But you were talking about could be problematic for Republicans is Medicaid as well as SNAP. Mm-hmm. Now, with Medicaid, if you talk to a Republican, they say we're only making people work. That's it. And here's what Senator Mark Wayne Mullen said. Cut eight.
What I'm saying is how do you explain that we only have 35, I say or only, I don't want to use that as a derogatory term, but I just want to use the numbers here. There's 35 million people under the poverty line inside the United States, and there's 70 million people that are signed up for Medicaid. That where are you going to tell me that there's not room to cut fraud, waste, and abuse in the program? People that are today eligible for it underneath current programs are still going to be eligible for it tomorrow, too. We're just getting out the ones that should never be there. I mean, what is so hard about requiring an able-bodied individual with no dependents, no sickness, to work 20 hours a week? I know you work more than 20 hours this weekend alone. What is so hard about having a work requirement there with someone that has no medical condition and no dependents? We don't pay people in this country to be lazy. Yeah.
Your thoughts?
My thoughts there are, you go back to Tom Tillis of North Carolina. Tom Tillis says, hold up. The problem with these Medicaid cuts, it's very worrisome to somebody like him because he actually says it's not just waste, fraud, and abuse that they're cutting. They are cutting services that would affect home and community-based services, which are vital for older adults. Older adults and some of the disabled who are legal citizens.
But Medicaid is supposed to be for the poor or the handicapped.
Yeah, the poor and the disabled, exactly.
Right, but don't you get Medicare when you're a senior?
You would, yes, exactly, at that certain level.
Yeah.
But in another point of all of this, you get people with the disabilities, and you could argue, okay, that there aren't that many of them. Well, yeah, but then you're also talking about the lower income people. And SNAP is, if you go to that part of the entire program that's being cut, SNAP is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. They want to cut $300 billion off that. And listen, Lindsey Graham is right. He said, well, this thing has exploded exponentially. Well, so has the defense budget over 5 years. So there are some—
I know why.
Yeah.
But I don't know why, but we haven't added more people. But we definitely have more enemies.
Yeah. Well, there are always enemies of America. I mean, you could go back 10 years and you see ISIS, and, you know, we go back 20 years in Iraq and, you know, Afghanistan. I mean, this stuff is very expensive, and we have to defend the nation, but we also have to take care of the nation. That's what the people who are voting against it or right now are holdouts are concerned about.
So what we have is Trump's long promised tax incentives for tips, overtime, and car loans. Seniors will get a tax break because I guess they don't fit in underneath the parliamentarian says they can't put them in on this. But they'll get a tax break at the end of the year. They can write off $5,000, I think it is. Extends the Trump's tax cuts. That's the key. Raise the child. They doubled the child tax credit. So the Democrats lost that. When it comes to SALT, it stays. Boost defense funding, billions for immigration enforcement. That's the wall and things like that. And raising the debt ceiling. And also, it looks like they've said they're adding to the state's SNAP
program. Well, so it's going to, right now, it will add $3.3 trillion to the deficit.
You believe the CBO?
I do.
Because they come back and they say, Democrat Republicans go, they score our average GDP at being 1.7.
Okay, no, they also dynamically scored it, Brian. So dynamically scoring is what the Republicans should want who are for this bill. That includes the sort of, you know, pie in the sky stuff. Well, it's just hard to quantify right now, but the potential growth from giving people all of these tax benefits, that was worse. That added more to the debt when the CBO scored it. They tried very hard to look at both sides of this. It looked a little more difficult here and more expensive. And when you focus specifically on some of what, say, for example, the House Freedom Caucus members are saying right now as they watch it go through the Senate, Chip Roy is threatening to sink it if it doesn't address more spending cuts. He's looking at it and saying, hold up, I got nominated, I got elected because of how I look at cuts in spending and trying to shrink government. John Thune, I believe it was, said this is actually going to be a start for cutting the debt. How is adding $3.3 trillion a start to cutting the debt of $37 trillion?
Well, what you got to do is pass this big thing. He wanted to do two. The speaker wanted to do one. Said, I can't do this twice because I'm not going to be able to get the votes. I have to counter what some people want in the blue states with the red states. I got to do it all at once. So the president says, let's do it all at once. But they feel as though they have two other shots at reconciliation over the next 2 years or a year and a half until the midterms. They have two other shots. So they think at that point they could go back. That's what I think his point was.
Well, for right now, the lane to passage is very narrow. And these guys are trying to take a page out of Formula One in the movie this weekend, which I did see and was fabulous. They're going that fast. They're trying to make that self-imposed July 4th deadline that the president really would like to see this thing on his desk. And it's a narrow passage at the moment.
Here's what Lindsey Graham said, the senator from South Carolina, Cut 5.
If you do what I have decided to do, make the tax cuts permanent, and you implement these reforms to Medicaid in other areas, you will, over the next 10 years, reduce the deficit by $507 billion. That's CBO, not me.
So Lindsey Graham speaking on the floor. Does that math make sense to you?
It's very hard to predict. Lindsey Graham's been around the block. He does his math. He's got a team there doing that. So I would love to err on the side of Lindsey Graham. But when you look at Tom Tillis, who, by the way, came out over the weekend and said, I care so much about voting against this thing until it cuts more that until it takes care of the Medicaid issue, that I'm not going to seek re-election.
How much of this is Medicaid has been basically doubled in size? It's really where Obamacare came from. It's where all the money is and the expansion of coverage came from. That's never expected the federal government to have this type of obligation. 95% of these new Medicaid coverage are from the federal government, and Medicaid is supposed to be a state program.
It's huge.
So they feel no responsibility in the states to watch their money and watch their coverage.
They should, absolutely, and they should be put on notice. But I believe this thing would poll better because the polling is atrocious right now from all sides.
38% approval.
Pew, Quinnipiac, Fox. I mean, the net approval is dismal, really dismal. And I believe that it would be easier to swallow if somebody on the higher end, and this was something President Trump even floated and said it's up to them, had a bit of giveaway when it came to their tax bracket, the high, high end. Now, already the wealthy are paying a lot.
Yeah.
But to be doing all of these giveaways, you got to pay for it somehow. You really do. And so I believe that the polling is really kind of people find this very sour and bitter pill to swallow at the moment because nobody at the higher end is giving up anything. That's how they view it.
Right. You only have 2/3 of the budget already spent. So you have 1/3 of discretionary spending. And that piece of the pie gets smaller every year.
Every single year.
Yeah. Who's coming up on your show? Liz?
Coming up on my show today. Well, we are landing Tim Scott of South Carolina. He's going to talk about the very updated latest on this Votorama big, beautiful bill. He's
by the way, he pushed back heavily on Tom Tillis yesterday.
Yeah, he did. He did. So he's coming on the show, top of the hour. We look at it through a total financial lens. We've got Kenny Polcari, who is a great investor, and he's going to talk a lot about exactly what's happening in the technology world, how important that is. Energy has become a huge story, Brian. And I'm not just talking about oil and gas. I'm talking about nuclear and fusion, which is a slightly different thing than actual nuclear. It's like modeling after how the sun does it. Google just made a deal with a company called Commonwealth out of Virginia, and they are coming on first on Fox Business to talk about exactly how they're going to do what they're going to do. Listen, funding energy is so crucial right now, and part of the problem that even some Republicans have with this big, beautiful bill is that it really kind of shortens the amount of time that green energy, wind and solar have to actually apply for their tax credits. The theory on behalf of those Republicans is, why are we limiting any form of energy when artificial intelligence is a huge energy gulper? We need all forms of it, whether it's fission or fusion or wind or solar. And to look at it just as green, I mean, they're trying to look at this as a much bigger picture of energy, not just the old school energy of coal, oil, and gas.
Wow. Liz Claman, what time is that?
3 p.m. Eastern, every single day.
On FBN.
Yep.
Liz Claman, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Always great having you in studio.
Brian, you're the best.
A very consequential day like this. And maybe we'll have some trade deals to talk about.
And by
soon.
The way, double records. We're on pace for the S&P and the NASDAQ to hit records again twice in a row.
Wow, that doesn't come up. Doesn't seem in the news that much, except for here. Hey, back in a moment.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Hey, thanks so much, everybody, by the way, who came out in Dayton. I just got to remind you, I'm going to go back on stage, History, Liberty, and Last. But the biggest venue yet and the biggest city we've been to, possibly, didn't do New York. Dallas, Texas, coming there August 23rd. It's going to be a big night. I think it's the Winspear Theater. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. If you are into patriotism, you like inspirational, motivational, I think it'll be a great night, and we have a good time. And then don't forget Richmond, Virginia, September 27th. So that'll be great, too. Greater chance for me to see all the listeners in person. Susan, you're in upstate New York. Hey, Susan.
Hi. Great show. You know, the mayor of New York City has control of the schools. And this is a great opportunity for Curtis as a Republican, because we own the charter school bill under Governor Pataki. And Adams has done nothing. And it's mostly minority children that are disproportionately in these failing, dangerous schools. So he needs to really, and he could work with the administration, Linda McMahon and President Trump. And in fact, this bill that they're going to pass, God willing, has a lot of school choice issues. And Curtis hasn't spoken about it. I love that he rescues animals, but he's got to rescue these children. They can't read, write, or do arithmetic.
What state are you, where are you upstate? What city?
Corning.
All right. So is there a charter school there?
Not that I know of. There's a lot of private schools. And by the way, the Catholic schools in New York City are, I lived in New York City for 40 years and I was involved with school choice. And this kills me that Curtis has this in the palm of his hands to rescue those children.
Right.
It's a $40 billion budget.
Absolutely. He should bring it up. Thank you. Sandra, listening in New Jersey. Hey, Sandra.
Brian, well, I care about the animals. You know, I was in the city yesterday and all the time, and I see all these lucky dogs and cats in their strollers, in their backpacks, walking around happy as can be. And I know that every dog I see, there's another dog on death row waiting to be euthanized in a matter of days. And these dogs and cats that go to these shelters come from homes where either the
I know,
the,
but what are we getting at? What's this grounded in, Sandra?
I'm saying that a vote for Sliwa is a vote to save the life of an innocent dog or cat.
Okay, good. So I think she more is foreign people, and he's not a communist or a socialist. Scott in North Carolina. Scott.
Ex-Department of Defense bunker complex outside of Dayton. And something I haven't heard anyone talk about is my ventilation shaft is baffled. It's like an accordion, and it's designed that way so that the blast gases don't shoot straight down. They go back and forth and are dissipated. And I haven't heard anyone else talk about that.
I did not know much about ventilation, but that's a good point. I don't know if it applies, but I know they did their research. They had all the schematics on Fordow in particular and Natanz, thanks to these outlaw groups and for the Israelis that either got Iranians working for them or they had Mossad on the inside. Thanks so much for the call, Scott. Appreciate it. So we'll see where this goes. You have a crazy mayoral candidate. This is round two, July 1st. That'll be tomorrow. They're going to have round two of the ranked choice voting. I'm sure he'll be fine there, too. And then we're going to find out if Eric Adams can mount a clear campaign with that is, you got to be close to Trump, but not too close to Trump. It is New York City. But at the same time, fuel a logic, practical path. Then you have Curtis Sliwa, who says, you had two shots at me. Make this the third one the charm. So we'll see where that goes. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't forget, One Nation Sundays at 10 o'clock. And you can always follow me on Twitter, on Facebook, as well as X and the Culper Club. Keep it here, Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.